The whole series that we have been doing was called A Theology of Peacemaking, with attention last week to the concept of God that is behind peacemaking, and then to personalities, Tolstoy, Gandhi, and King, as followers of Jesus. Then the last two sessions were the other current of concern about peace through Western Christian history, the so-called just war tradition, which is leading people to the conclusion that without being pacifist, it's also imperative to set limits to what can be done in war. The eighth title is When You Can't Rule the World with the Gospel. That's a phrase from Martin Luther. What then should you do? The other title, When All Else Fails, comes from Larry Rasmussen. I'm not quite sure what it means, because it sounds as if you had first tried to rule the world with the gospel and failed, and now what do you do? And maybe you didn't try, or maybe you shouldn't try. But let's start with that phrase anyway. An almost unchallenged assumption in our culture is that we ought to be in charge of history. We ought to make events come out right. Conservative people take that to mean that they should participate in keeping things as they are, because most change is not for the better. People who are more critical, or sometimes called liberal, think that we should help things to change because change would be for the better. Even the people who are far out on the right, who are reactionary, want to back up, or people on the far left who are revolutionary and want change to be so rapid that there's breakage, all of them have a recipe and want history to go their way. And they all tend to agree that the way to do that is to have power, to take over, to dominate. And they all tend to think that if you don't agree with them that the thing to do is to take power and dominate, that you must not care. You must be only interested in the spiritual, or you must not care about the real world. Otherwise, you too would want to make it come out right. Now, as we saw very briefly at the beginning of last week, and as everybody knows a little, as I have argued at much more length in my book on Jesus, Jesus didn't choose either of those positions. He didn't choose to take charge of history by dominating, but neither was he unconcerned. Neither was he only interested in another world, in the spirit or the inward or the individual. He cared about history. He cared about the needs of real people, about justice, injustice, poverty, the outsider, class divisions. And yet he rejected the world's way of doing that. And right there we have two usages of the word world. Jesus cared about the world's needs. There the word world means everybody, and especially those who have needs, the needy of the world. And yet he rejected the world's way. And there I use the word the way John's gospel does much of the time and John's epistles. And that is the fallen way things are out there, with its selfishness and its oppressiveness and its concern for violence and dominion. For us, because we live in the West, where there have been a millennium and a half of Christian history, it's a thinkable thing to do. We ought to take charge of the world, because we come from Christian countries, and we come from a long history in which Europe was ruled, our ancestors helped to rule Europe in a Christian way. So we see it as a question: shall we govern the world or not? It was also a question for Jesus, who had a choice to make. I talked about it a little last night. But we have to remember that for the early Christians, it wasn't a real question. The New Testament Christians could not possibly have thought about being in charge of the world. There just weren't enough of them. They didn't have the status, they didn't have power. It wasn't that they were taking a moral position, such as the wrongness of taking life, or the wrongness of being in politics, and therefore concluding that they would withdraw from civil responsibility, there were just too few of them to count. And it's still the case, this is, we also forget, in most of the world today, it is evangelical Christians in the Soviet Union, any kind of Christians in continental China, any kind of Christians anywhere in the part of the world that's dominated by Islam, there is no question of their being in charge of the world. They never had a Constantine. And now they never had a post-Christian anti-religious revolution like Eastern Europe. But when Luther said you can't run the world with the gospel, he didn't mean that there aren't enough of you. He meant that there's something about how the world has to be run that is not compatible with the gospel. And that means that he begins with a picture of the gospel as portraying a way of life, love of the enemy, bearing the cross, sharing one's goods, but that way you're not going to get the job done. Luther agreed as to the content of the gospel, that an individual should love his or her enemies, should turn the other cheek, should not be defensive, should be willing to bear the cross, should be willing to suffer unjustly. But that could only apply to the individual or to persons in small-scale relationships. It couldn't apply to government, and therefore we have to have a different level on which to get our signals for running the world. So now there are three reasons we can't run the world with the gospel. The one would be the first century picture, you have no clout, but that might change. The second would be that it's unimportant how the world runs because we only care about spiritual matters. That one Jesus didn't recognize. There are a lot of people who think that, but I would reject it and argue against it. The third reason is therefore the one that counts the most, and that is that if you love your enemy, you're not going to be effective. That the rejection of techniques of lordship and the tactics of dominating people means that you won't get the things done that have to be done to run the world. Well, then what are you going to do instead? And that's where our analysis now really starts after having stated the question. If you can't run the world with the gospel, then what do you do? The majority Christian positions, and now I'm just going to be setting out a typology, a set of ways of reasoning, will say, well then, there will be two of these answers, you should run the world without the gospel. That is, you should explicitly say, in order to take charge of social events for the sake of the welfare of people and good causes, we will have to use other rules in the gospel. We will have to set aside gospel style, recognizing that it's there, but it must be limited to another area of concern and relevance in order that in the real world we can be realistic. Now, then we'll have two options, especially that count from Christian history. There would be more if I would be a careful scholar at this time. But one is to run the world by its own rules. That is, you look at the world and see how it goes. Well, you always have rulers, and you always have rulers clobbering people in order to keep the power. And then once they have the power, they can do some good with that power. But first of all, they have to maintain their power by gathering money and not loving their enemies. Its own rules might mean law in the sense of actually the laws that exist, that is, the laws of the Romans or the laws of the Germans. It might also mean the claim that there's some law in the nature of things. The natural law isn't just the laws of the Germans or the laws of the Romans, but it's the way things have to be. Everywhere in the world you have princes, everywhere in the world you have patriarchs, everywhere in the world you have national enmity. In any case, those rules don't come from the gospel. You don't get them from Jesus. You get them from the way things are out there. They're different from the gospel as to source, and they're also different from the gospel as to content, because they tell you to do things that the gospel doesn't tell you to do. The gospel tells you to love your enemies, and the rules out there tell you to hate your enemies, or at least to destroy them if you have to. Sometimes it is said that those rules are there in creation, that God put them there. And yet the difficulty about carrying through with that thought is that it has to be a fallen creation. It isn't the way God made the creation. In the way God made the creation, there weren't enemies, and there wasn't killing, and there wasn't the discrimination between rich and poor. within the idea that creation made things that way, which was very important in the 16th century social thought because they thought of society as stable, it comes down for the individual to know where is your place in life, your vocation, where God has called you to be, which tended to mean the same thing as your job, your social setting, or sometimes in technical theology they call it the office or the station. The place in society where you are is where God has put you, so you do what that calls for. So that if you are a hangman, you put people to death, even though Jesus said you shouldn't. If you are a soldier, you kill people, even though Jesus said you shouldn't. If you are a banker, you take good care of your money and you take interest on it, even though Jesus said that you shouldn't. Because what it means to be a banker is that that's what you do with money. And what it means to be a soldier is that that's what you do with enemies. So that source of guidance in what the job is like is what guides us instead of the gospel. And you do that, if you're a Christian, unselfishly. The faith adds something, but it doesn't tell you what to do that's different, because that wouldn't be reasonable and that would be doing violence to the fact that the world has to be dealt with in its own terms. If you're a believer, then you won't be proud, you won't be self-righteous about what you do in your vocation, you will recognize that you are finite, that you're a sinner, you will be conscientious about going about your duties. But what your duties are, you don't get from the gospel, you get from the way the world is. That position tends to be conservative, obviously, then, socially, because it goes by the standards of the way things are. Although there are times that a conservative authority can make great changes in the name of conservative vision. The caricature of this, that is a real caricature, it really happened, but it isn't fully faithful to what Martin Luther wanted when he started thinking this way, would be the people who called themselves German Christians. It wasn't all of the Christians in Germany, but it was a movement in the 1930s who said that since we have Hitler governing us, it must be that God gave us Hitler to govern us. Therefore, we will, with a good conscience, support Hitler and the things he tells us to do, because that's the way things are. The shape of society has been given us. The German nation, obviously we're created as a German nation, and now we are being renewed as a German nation with a sense of nationhood and a sense of purpose. And if God gave us a leader who did that, then our Christian responsibility is to follow that leader. And there were a lot of conscientious Lutherans who did that. I say it's a caricature because it goes farther in that direction than most people did, but it was a possibility with that way of thinking. The second way of ruling the world not with the gospel, is instead of separating clearly between the two directions, to believe that in the world there is a divine movement toward the kingdom of God. God wants the world not to stay as it is, conservatively, but to change. And therefore, we need to take charge of history in order to move it forward, not just to leave it stand. God can't change history without us, so we have to help God make the world more righteous. That means that we will intervene, we will get religious reasons to change the world. For instance, we will know that one form of government is more righteous than another, and we will use, if necessary, revolution to make those changes in some cases. At the same time as Martin Luther, there lived Huldrych Zwingli, who was the father of the Reformed tradition. We call it Calvinist, but Calvin came along a generation later. Its real father was Huldrych Zwingli. He himself died on the battlefield in a war that he told his government God wanted, of the Protestant cantons of Switzerland against the Catholic cantons of Switzerland. Because God does require things to be done through the civil order, not like Jesus, but like the good kings of the Old Testament, or like the Christian emperors of the 4th and 5th centuries of the ancient Roman Empire after Constantine's conversion. And that expresses itself then in the wars of religion that happened very soon around Europe. In England, there was the age of Oliver Cromwell, who led a successful revolution against the British royal house. It's like the Crusades in the Middle Ages, and in some ways it's like some currents in today's liberation theology. It is that God wants war, if necessary, government in any case, to do things to God's enemies for the sake of justice. Just as Joshua, or good King Josiah, or the good emperors Justinian and Theodosius, wanted to have a righteous society and did whatever it took by way of sharing with the government in order to bring that about. Those are the two clean answers with their caricatures for running the world without the gospel. On the other end of the scale, we could say, well, we want to stay with the gospel, but that means we can have nothing to do with the world. We'll let the world go its own way, and we'll just be Christian in the realm that we can take responsibility for, which means individual family relations, small-scale relations, the church by itself. One can say that because the world is fundamentally evil, and we can't do anything about it until God changes things. The strongest representatives of that position are the Jehovah's Witnesses. We can also say it isn't for us to do, because we as Christians have a special Christian task to live according to the gospel and proclaim the gospel, but it's all right that God is using those other forces out there for good. He may use them for good, he just doesn't need us. God could use a pagan Caesar in the first century. What we read in Romans 13 about government being a servant of God for your good, as Paul wrote to the Christians at Rome, is being said about pagan authorities. So pagan authorities can do some good things. We'll leave that to God. God doesn't need us to make the world come out right, but at least God needs us to stay out of running the world, because he can do that himself. Now, it's hard really to stay out, but people can believe that they're staying out and can draw the line between politics and not politics, for instance, or between worldly pursuits and spiritually possible pursuits, and be Christian, make a social contribution on the scale that you can take responsibility for, but let the world go its own way, either if you think it's going to the dogs or that somehow there is kind of secular decency that will take care of itself without our being involved. One good example of trying to draw the line was a person I didn't personally meet, but I met one of his close acquaintances. He was at that time, several years back, the top bureaucrat in the financial administration of Northern Ireland, which, as you know, is a country at war. He was a world-renowned expert on techniques of taxation and collection and budgeting in government, so much so that he would be called in as a consultant around the world, especially in some of the ex-colonies of Black Africa, as those nations got their own fiscal system set up, to give them advice about how to set up a good fiscal system. And yet he was completely unconcerned about politics. That's the way he said it. He was a member of the Plymouth Brethren community, which believes that Christians should stay out of politics. He did a clean job, he never cheated, he kept the books right, but he didn't take sides, he didn't get into parliament, he didn't vote, he just did a decent job of keeping books. He happened to keep the books for governments. But he was clean of involvement in politics, because politics is when you run for office, and when you take sides and join a party. That's a specimen of the difficulty of making that kind of distinction, but there are many people in the world, not only Plymouth Brethren, who think that you can do that. And those are the clean answers. You run the world without the gospel, or you forsake running the world. The other possibility would be to say, I won't accept that that's the question. I refuse to choose between relevance and faithfulness. How could one argue that? Well, one could say that the question itself is set up in a biased way. That is, if you think the only way to help with the way history goes is to be a king, or to run the world by means of unchristian ethics, maybe you haven't looked at all the opportunities. Maybe your way of saying either or is itself skewing the question. The question is biased by taking establishment assumptions. The theological way to say it would be that if Jesus renounced the path of lordship and is yet the risen Lord, then there must be something more about the universe than people have thought about yet, when they think the only way to be important historically is to be a king. So then we'll look at ways to claim to be relevant and faithful at the same time. And again, we'll have several. One is the polar counterculture. That is, we will show the world that there's another way to be a world, another way to live, another way to be social. We'll get enough people together that they can show that they can make decisions without having patriarchal authority structures, that they can love each other, that they can share in economic well-being, that they can be productive. The things that a society needs to do can be done differently, according to the gospel. And in order to show that, we will do it on our own. You can't do it right in the midst of everybody else because it isn't visible and maybe not be possible, but you can have a colony of your own. There were people like this that talked about counterculture in the 60s and early 70s. But the people that have done it most thoroughly are people of the communal traditions that have arisen off and on through church history, of which the best example is the so-called Hutterian Brethren, who go back to 1528 and have recently been joined by new people from other sources, who run what they call a Bruderhof, that is, a fraternal household, which may have anywhere from 25 to 200 people. Have more than 200, then they break it up and start over. With community of goods, with democratic decision making, with utter nonviolence in conflict relationships, to show that you can have a world according to the gospel. And if anybody else is attracted to that, they're welcome to come. The very existence of a group like that is a reproach to the rest of the world. But they don't try to take over the rest of the world. They don't impose their pattern on the rest of the world, unless the Western rest of the world happens to notice. It happened that they have one commune just a couple miles from where Malcolm Muggeridge lives, so he has recently started describing their virtues. Most of them, however, are in the plains of Montana and the Dakotas and Alberta, so where they don't, their reproach to the world isn't very visible to most people. But you run a society according to the gospel. And let the, so you don't agree that it's only for inward relationships, and you don't agree that it's only for small-scale relationships, but it is only for Christians. So you can't impose it on the wider society. A second approach is to live that different way, but do it in a way that is not a reproach completely to the wider society, because you have to live with the wider society. The best example of this is St. Francis, who took on the ethics of Jesus globally, poverty, nonviolence, servanthood, and yet did it in society and was dependent on society for the continuances of his form for two reasons. One is that the economic support of the Franciscans was by begging. You don't produce your own food and other needs, but you ask other people for that because it's good for your soul and it's good for their soul that they should give you something. That means, of course, that at the same time that you reproach other people that they are living for wealth, you still live off their wealth and give them a good conscience because they give you a part of it. And the second reason, of course, was that these movements are celibate so that they don't produce their own children but are dependent always on the people who don't live in the same lifestyle for their own future membership. So they don't deal with the question of posterity and family. They're symbiotic. At the same time, they live in the world a lifestyle that is a reproach to the world. These positions are both, in a sense, dependent on the world they reject, because it's only over against the world that they get defined. Now you must have guessed that there must be a better answer as there was to the first question. And I see that as already represented in the meaning of the call to Abraham. Abraham was called to be the initiator of a new kind of family. It was still to be his family, his posterity, but they were not to be any more like the population of Chaldea from which he was called. A global religious culture. They were to be footloose. They were to be interlocked with another society, but different from it. They were to have their own standards, but not the standards of a given province And ultimately, as this vision developed and was clarified through the Hebrew experience, they were claiming that the God who called the children of Abraham to live in this very special way was the God of everybody, even though everybody doesn't know it. It wasn't just a provincial style preference that made them Hebrews, it was the call of the only true God. Now, the Hebrews had to struggle for generations about efforts to nail this thing down. They tried to nail it down to the land. They tried to nail it down to the national structure, especially the throne of David. They tried to nail it down in a mixture with the fertility religions and the power religions of the time, the worship of the Baalim, the various lords of the various hillsides, the religion of the other people in Canaan. With time, all of these nailings down of the new community were rejected by history and by the prophets. So after Jeremiah, there will no longer be, on God's side, within the history of the ongoing life of the scattered people, a centralization on the land, although Jerusalem will continue to be spiritually and symbolically important. There will no longer be a kingship, and there will no longer be idolatry, as there had been constantly struggling with the Yahweh religion before the end of the kingdom. By Jeremiah, this is sorted out, and the Hebrew people are ready to live as scattered, diaspora. Jesus takes this same vision, fills it out, clarifies it, and expands it. Jesus, plus his apostles, expanded by making it accessible to the whole world as a missionary faith. So now we have a community that lives in the world, but not of the world, that cares about how the world goes, but doesn't take over the world, and is ready and able, willing, to live with no clout. Refusing idolatry and immorality, and therefore dissenting at basic levels of lifestyle from the wider society, but living among the people it dissents from. Maintaining family life and productive economic work, but without glorifying that or without taking its economic virtues only for oneself. Maintaining the believing community with prayer, ritual, synagogue-like structures, what the sociologists called a deviant consciousness, that is, keeping alive a different way of seeing the world than the way the rest of the world sees itself, and yet open to others, not seeking a ghetto existence that other people can't enter. In fact, convinced that this message is for others. Well, when you can't run the world with the gospel, you can do that. You can be like the early Christians. You can represent a chunk of the world that's in the process of being saved. You can represent a different way of dealing with money, food, bread, namely by sharing it, rather than developing class distinctions. You can have a different way of dealing with the enemy, namely by loving the enemy instead of seeking his or her destruction. You can have a different way of dealing with the power questions, namely by sharing power in the community dialogically instead of having patriarchs and bureaucrats. You can be a different world in the midst of the world with the conviction that it's that kind of world that God wants to lead the whole world to, but not by your taking it over, but rather in his own way and time. And if you are in the situation of the Baptists in the Soviet Union, or the Christians in China today, or the Christians in Iran today, that's all you can do. And that's enough. There is no duty to be theocratic and take over the world. There is no duty to help the world do its dirty work on its grounds, according to the theory of creation or the station. No, this is the most important thing you can do when you have no clout. When, on the other hand, you have breathing space and numbers, then there are other ways in which this kind of community can contribute to the wider course of history without seeking lordship and without seeking a second level of morality that is drawn from the world instead of from the gospel. So now I'll look at the times when the Christian subcommunity, minority, not granting that in order to be useful to the world you have to abandon the gospel. Not claiming to take over the world like a Zwinglian, a Calvinist theocrat, crusader, can still be responsibly involved in the way the world goes. And now I'll just have a series of examples side by side, each of which has some weight, and how much weight it would have in a given circumstance would depend on the cases and numbers and individuals. One way the minority can contribute to the wider society is by refusing to go along with the way the wider society goes, but not simply being persecuted or put to death, the way that happens in times of extreme danger, but claiming that it's right not to do what they tell you to do. That is, dissenting, but claiming that it's right to dissent. And there is a sense, of course, in which Western political democracy began when they began recognizing the rights of dissent, that you don't have to be all the same in order to maintain a civil society. That is, that the person who refuses to do what government says, or sometimes what somebody else says, not only says, I can't do it, because it would be counter to the law of God or the gospel or my conscience, but also says, it would be in your interest not to make me do it. You would be a better government if you wouldn't make me do it. And this goes all the way back to the second century when Tertullian, one of the main spokesmen of the nonviolence of the early Christians, said to the Roman Empire, we're really good citizens. If you didn't persecute us, it would be better for you, and you would be a better government. A government which wastes its energy persecuting Christians who are doing it no harm is not a better government. It's a worse government. So you would be a better government if you would give us the freedom of our dissent and not try to make us conform. In the Western experience, that has been the most clear in the in conscientious objection, that is, with regard to military service. The conscientious objector, or the selective conscientious objector, says, I cannot participate in that military activity, and claims that a government that wouldn't try to make him do it would be a better government than one that does try to make him do it. So it's not antisocial, it's not anti-governmental, it's in favor of a better vision of the common life than the one which seeks to make everybody conform. Another dramatic example of this, which Lutherans were especially concerned about 15, 20 years ago, was the development in the time when in East Germany the clash between the Marxist government and the church leadership was the strongest, of a socialist equivalent of confirmation, the Jugendweihe. It was the subject of a film called Question 7, which was actually produced by the Lutheran churches in America and circulated around here. I don't know if anybody remembers having seen it. It is the government and school authorities of East Germany pushed very hard that a young person, instead of being confirmed in the church, would go through a ceremony of commitment to socialism. It wasn't absolutely required, but it was very strongly encouraged. And if you didn't do it, your chances for going on to higher schools or professional promotion were less. But there were people who said, I can't. And they said that the German Democratic Republic would be a better republic, would be more democratic if they didn't make us do that. It's that kind of dissent which is a contribution to the quality of life of the wider community by challenging its making itself God. That is, the sovereignty of God is made operational when I say to a government that wants me to do something wrong that for God's sake I won't do that. Then I say the government isn't my God. That's conscientious non-participation as a contribution to the welfare of society. But then there's also conscientious participation. When you can do what needs to be done, what they want done, then to participate according to your own convictions. But not, as the older doctrine of the station would say, you do the opposite of what the gospel calls for because the job calls for it. No, you can change the job and make the job not call for it. Don't claim that the demands of the job are inflexible because they come from creation. Everybody knows what a banker is, everybody knows what a hangman is, etc. But actually claim that these functions in society can be changed if the gospel has an impact on them. And this is the place of the standard debate between the high traditional Protestant position with its view of the job, the station, the vocation, as telling you what you must do, and the gospel as changing that. It's always struck me as a little odd in these debates, and this is a classical debate. If you haven't heard of it, it's still back there in the books for four centuries, that Lutherans and Calvinists will say it is very important that Christians ought to be in every place in society, filling every job, so that it will be done well. But then when I ask, but what will be the rules as to how it ought to be done, then they'll say, well, the same as any other person, because it isn't to be guided by the gospel, it has to be guided by the rules of the world. In fact, Luther said that a reasonable Turk can be just as good a prince as any Christian, because what it takes to be a prince, you don't get from the gospel, you get from reason. Well, then if a reasonable Turk will do it, why do you have to take it away from him instead of living by the gospel instead? That is, why is it better to have Christians running the world not by the gospel than to have non-Christians running the world not by the gospel? Well, why do we need Christians if that's what they're supposed to do? But that was a polemic deviation. A Mennonite pastor who had been involved in prison reform activity as a voluntary activity and was therefore known, at the occasion of a change in party in the government of, I think it was Alberta, was invited to be a prison warden. He had been complaining before about how the prisons were managed, and now there's a new government in office, and all the patronage positions are up for grabs, and so he has a chance to be a different kind of prison warden. Should he accept it? He doesn't believe in violence. He doesn't believe in killing. But there are going to be prisons anyway. Can he participate in trying to implement prison reform from the top? Well, not quite the top, but the top of that institution. And he thought that if he didn't at least try this challenge, then he wouldn't have the right to complain about the way things were going. So he did accept it. But he didn't accept the definition of what a prison warden is and how you have to run a prison. He changed those things. There are other things he changed by way of atmosphere and style, but the most dramatic thing was that he took the guns away from the guards and put them in a closet. And somehow it wasn't any harder to run the prison without guns than with guns on the guards. Then there was a standard housekeeping rule that once a year the ammunition has to be thrown away and new ammunition has to be purchased for all the guns. He threw away the old, but he didn't buy the new and saved the province $1,000. Then he was called back from vacation with the news that there was a riot going on and that the prisoners were making certain demands and that the guards didn't know what to do. He wasn't far enough away that he couldn't get back, so he got back in a hurry and learned that the guards were just about ready to get out the guns. And he said to them that you don't have any ammunition. They said, but the prisoners don't know that. He said, but I'm going to tell them. So he walked out in the courtyard and talked to the people, and the riot was over. Because he didn't use guns on them. He didn't use the normal things that a warden does or that the police coming from outside do. He dealt with his adversaries, his charges, his inmates, as persons, found out what their grievance was and what could be done about it, by making himself vulnerable, and the riot was over. Now, I don't mean to say that always happens, but if it can ever happen, then it's not logically right to say that the only way to run the world is to be tough. Sometimes you can change the shape of society by bringing the gospel's vision to bear on it. That doesn't mean that prison reform was complete. No, there was a change in government, and he was out on his ear, and now he's farming. But there are times and places for victories in changing the shape of the world, because you don't let them tell you that it can't be done because the world is that way. Another component of this picture is that you, maybe you have trouble believing, but you act as if you believe and you say that you believe and sometimes you believe that the oppressor could repent. You don't just say it could be better. This system is so bad, another system would be better. You actually look at the persons in power and say that they could be better. They could be decent. They could repent. That's biblical language. This conflict could be resolved. And this is the level on which actually there has been learning in the last century. In the experience of conflict resolution, nonviolent direct action, as represented, but not uniquely, by Gandhi and King, you come at a situation of social conflict with the doctrine, with the conviction that comes from the gospel, that there is a solution. There could be a reconciling solution. There would be a way to resolve that conflict if you got all the facts and if you got all the personalities in relation to each other and got everybody's attention. Usually the nonviolent tactics of sitting in or getting in the road or marching are just a way to get people's attention to the possibility of a new arrangement of things, and you believe that the people on the other side can be called upon to change. Now, we find it easier than the Indians found it in the 20s and 30s to believe that a British imperial administrator could change. We tend to think that the British are gentlemen, and certainly Gandhi was better off having the British administrators and British public opinion to try to convert than if he had been working at a Japanese military government or if Idi Amin had taken over India. But it was still a leap of faith to believe that the empire could be converted and brought to back out of India, ultimately freely, although it took a generation. As you call upon people with power to repent of the way they're using power because you believe that the offer to them that they could relinquish the way they're using their power is good news for them. It's in line with their dignity. You don't want to destroy them. You want them to be more decent. You want them to be more human by being less oppressive. And you offer that to them as good news, not as bad news, as a way that they could respect themselves more, as a way that they could be more open to one another. Instead of being oppressors, they could be the administrators of a more wholesome social system. Next point, again, these things don't quite go in a row, being all the same size and shape. The gospel testifies to a bias in favor of the victim in any social setting. And it's especially possible for a minority group to express that bias. Now, this doesn't mean that the victims are better people. God isn't on the side of the poor because the poor are better people than the rich. Once in a while, there are certain virtues which correlate with poverty or just correlate with not having had the chance to change rapidly. There are some things about the generosity of minority groups, about their family solidarity, that may actually be socially healthier than those of the social climbing upper middle class. But that's not the point. Even if the social fabric of a victim group is demoralized and falling apart, there's still in the gospel, in the God of the gospel, a preference to stand by those people in their suffering. Not because they're better. Not because if they came to rule, they would be better rulers. It might sometimes be the case, but it often wouldn't be the case. But just because they're in the bottom, and that's where God stands. And it's easier to understand that if you yourself are part of a minority community. To move now one step beyond what I said about good news for the oppressor, the faith in the resurrection doesn't mean, shouldn't mean only, that we repeat the words about what happened when the first disciples' community saw the risen Lord and from then on started preaching about the resurrection of Jesus as having happened. The resurrection becomes already in the New Testament and appropriately in theological elaboration the basis for believing that there can be newness in other times and places, on other questions. That is, it's a basis for creativity, for not believing that there are only two choices. Now, very often in an ethical discussion, you have only two choices. You either have to kill somebody or they'll kill you. Or in other ways, the question is set up so that there are only two things that can happen. And usually, those hard cases are used in books about situation ethics or about political ethics to undercut the rules and say you always have to do something wrong. But if you believe in the resurrection, there often aren't only two possibilities. There are other possibilities you just haven't thought of yet. Or you didn't trust long enough to look for them. Or you didn't see things in a long enough time frame to recognize that maybe sacrifice now will contribute to victory at some other time. That the world in which we are, if the resurrection happened and if there is a Holy Spirit, is not boxed in. And the strongest example of this that struck me when I read it a long time ago, 20 years or so ago, was from the East German Lutheran pastor Johannes Hamel, who wrote small articles that were translated in two books in English, but they aren't in the library here, I couldn't find them. In the time when the clash between the churches and the Marxist government was the strongest in East Germany, one of the questions, I think the particular case he was talking about, was are we going to tell the truth? For instance, if you are a committed church-going Lutheran, and they ask you in the factory, which is part of the socialist structure, about it, will you affirm that, even at the cost of losing your chances for job promotion, or losing the chance that your teenager will be able to get in the university, or do you try to hide it, or you maybe actually back away from church going in order to become a kind of secret believer in order not to suffer, or other kinds of dilemmas that arise about truth-telling. And the picture that he uses is that if you're living a life of faith, you can walk right up to a wall, and when you get to the last centimeter, you discover there's a door there. That is, you don't believe that the universe is closed. You don't believe that in a dilemma there are only two bad things to do, and you must choose the lesser evil. Of course, if you do believe that, you'll be right. Because you won't expect anything else. You won't hope for anything else. But if you do trust that the world is under a providential liberator who's in the business of resurrection, and the Holy Spirit makes that real in our life, then you won't assume that there are no options, and then you'll look for options. Sometimes that will mean that you'll have the freedom to take the path of suffering. Other times it will mean that you'll actually discover something that wouldn't have happened if you hadn't believed that it could. Now, to take another kind of illustration, I keep forgetting whether it's 8 or 6. Anybody remember the Ingrid Bergman movie, The Inn of the 8th or 6th Happiness?
6th.
Well, it was 6th. Well, it was really 8th. It's a true story, and they changed it from 8 to 6 for some reason in the movie. I didn't remember which way it was. But it was a true story of a British faith missionary lady who was all alone in northern China. Had been there long enough that people came to respect her. In fact, she had the peculiar job of being the provincial foot inspector, because the Chinese government at the time was trying to get people to stop binding the feet of baby girls, and so they gave her the mandate to go out and keep looking at all the feet of baby girls on behalf of the Mandarin. But this truly did happen, that the news came while she was having tea with the provincial ruler that there was a riot in jail. And of course, jails there were even worse than our jails. And it wasn't really a riot. There was a crazy man with an axe running around cutting people open. And the Mandarin says, you say your God is powerful. See what you can do. And she didn't really think she could do anything, but she'd been talking about Jesus all these years and didn't quite have the nerve to say no to the challenge. So she walked to the gate and had herself led into, it was just one great big courtyard with this maniac running around. She prayed and walked in and looked at him and took the axe away from him. Now, she couldn't have done that, But she did, because she believed that she could. Well, that's a specimen of the potential for changing the world if you believe that the world can be changed, which is impossible if you have a doctrine of creation or of the vocation which says that the world can't be changed. Now, that's an overstatement again. I mean, that's like the man in the Alberta prison. It's a good example, and not all of them are good. But suffering for the sake of that hope is also a part of the gospel story. Now, these five or six points along the way are just scattered observations about the more fundamental fact that you need to have a special kind of community of people to live this way. You can't do it on your own. You can't just read a book and say, I'm going to do this. There needs to be a number of people belonging together and living together so as to support one another in this kind of insight. And that's what the New Testament says about the church. The church is not everybody, but it is the people who already know what God is calling everybody to and are already living in those terms. So the New Testament uses the image of first fruits or down payment. That is, the down payment is the same as what it'll take finally when the rest of the money is paid, but you just have a little of it now. But what you have a little of is what there will be more of. Or first fruits likewise are what there will be more of when the rest of the harvest has been gathered. And in that sense, the community is called to be what the world is called to be. And what are the marks of that community? Well, this is kind of going through the same things I was talking about before, but just in another direction. A prior loyalty to God over any other value, so that we would never let some other value be our God. Technical word for that is idolatry. But that has to be cashed out in real terms. And we saw it Monday evening in discussion of the just war tradition. Is there anything which you would not do if you had to do it to win a war? If there is nothing you would not do, then you don't hold to the just war tradition. You really have sold out to government or to the crusading mentality. If there is something which you would refuse to do, even if at that cost you had to lose the war, then you are holding to the just war tradition. And then you have denied that government or the survival of your nation is an idol. But there has to be a point at which you would reject something. If God's God. So does the godness of God show at some point where you are willing to put something else in second or third or fourth or nth place? Similarly, do you make a prior commitment, do we make a prior commitment to the world community? That is, do we think of Russians or of Afghani as just as human as we are? Or is the American nation or the North American culture our real ultimate social loyalty? A prior commitment to the rest of the world over against our selfish communities is a mark of the new world that's on its way. There's a Southern Presbyterian history professor. Now the Presbyterians have merged, so now he's just a Presbyterian, but he was Southern Presbyterian until last year, named Smiley, who wrote a very perceptive description of the Americanization of the churches about 20 years ago. He said that America has replaced the church for many people. For most people, if you ask, if you caught them on the streets of Paris or London and ask, what are you? Most wouldn't say, I'm a Southern Presbyterian. And they wouldn't say, I'm a Christian. They would say, I'm American. That's your basic identity. It's the thing about your identity that comes first for many people. The second way he said it is that people expect from the national structures meaningful movement in history. When you ask what's going to save the world from communism, or when you ask what's going to save the world from anything, or what's going to foster the welfare of humankind, most people think first about what the national structure should do, unless they're very conservative Republicans, and then they think about what the business structure should do, but still it's the American business structure. You don't think first about what believers in Jesus would do. And thirdly, he said, moral discipline is now the business of the civil authorities. Most people don't want the church to know, or the pastor, or the pastor's secretary to know how much they earn, but they tell Internal Revenue that. Most people don't want their neighbors to be asked by the pastor about their lifestyle or who's been coming and going in the house. But if you apply for the job of the federal government, it's all right that the FBI goes and asks your neighbors about who's been consorting with you. So it's actually expected that there be a moral oversight of the civil community over me. That's Smiley's report. We could add other elements of where you are really at home, what you see as the meaning of historical process, focused more on the nation than on the body of Christ. If we are going to have the believing community be this kind of community, that means we have to look at the basis of membership. How do people get to be members? Are they drawn in automatically by being the children of members, or is there a point at which they must make their own decision? We need to ask about what Eucharist means, not just a ceremony with superficial symbolic meaning, this means this, the body means the body, the bread means the body, but what the celebration together of the breaking of bread meant in the early church was that people shared their bread. That they ate together. They ate real meals together. That is, their economic support base was interlocked, whether they had a strict common purse, as in Jerusalem, or other forms of sharing, as in Corinth. We'll need accountability. The early church talks about, and the 16th century Reformation talked about, my responsibility for the sin of my brother and sister. Especially clear in Matthew 18, if your brother is, and that should be taken inclusively, if any fellow member of the church is guilty of something, reconciliation with that person is your business. You don't tell the preacher, you don't tell the cops, you don't just let it go, you don't gossip about it. You go and talk to that person with the intent of reconciliation, accountability, interlocking moral accountability. Another dimension would be what we see especially in the writings of Paul, a unity in diversity, the multiplicity of gifts, where everybody has something to do that's essential for the body, and everyone has something different to do, so that we don't let the pastor be the one that runs the church. We all are parts of the church, and each with his and her own function. Those are some of the New Testament marks of the kind of community that can, in the world, be responsible for the world, but without running according to gospel, to non-gospel norms. Now we have a good quarter of an hour to... No, we don't. Do we stop at 10:50 or 11:50 or at 12? I guess we have 4 minutes for the bell for people in the first meal. Excuse me. 4 minutes.
Just to go back to your concept or your discussion of the Russian Christians, isn't the thing there that if they don't get out of line, particularly evangelism-wise, they just stay in their own, like the Russian Orthodox in their churches and do what the state expects them to do, that they are all right, but it was these evangelists that got out of line and did things they were told not to do. Isn't that the problem in some other communist countries?
Yeah, that's a problem in many cases. We can still discuss whether if we were there, we would say that they should be more courageous and get in more trouble with the government here or there. And that would be something to debate. And in fact, the Baptists of the Soviet Union are divided on that question. Some of them register with the government and stay in their churches, and others say that that's the wrong thing to do and are willing to go to prison for refusing to register. But in both cases, they accept the fact that the impact they can have on the wider society will not be through any chance they'll ever have to take over or to tailor their ethics in order to be able to be powerful. Their impact as Christians on the society has to be through their living a Christian life in their terms. And generally, some of them, actually, there are conscientious objectors among the Baptists in the Soviet Union who refuse to kill. There are others who have given up on that strong commitment. But still, with the Christians of the first century, would never think that they should tailor their ethics in order to be effective in helping run the Soviet Union. That was my question.
But they are allowed to be Christian if they stay within certain guidelines.
Well, the degree of repression varies. There have been times when they were actually chased and persecuted. Mm-hmm. Right now, and this has been pretty much the case for the last 20 years, if they stay very quiet and live only their internal life, then they aren't persecuted. But they still are powerless. And I was talking about the question of powerlessness and accepting your powerlessness rather than trying to buy into the system in order to change it.
Well, here you're saying that as living in America, we have a greater responsibility to cause change.
Yeah, we have far more freedom, and therefore we can do many more of these other things that you can only do when you have freedom. But that it's a mistake to think that because we have more freedom, therefore we ought to lower our standards and buy into the system on its own terms. We should rather be more ambitious about the possibility of shaking the system in gospel terms, which we shouldn't ask of our Soviet brothers to do.
Does Luther's splitting up of thinking in the doctrine of the two kingdoms also go farther into sort of thinking about the Christian and the secular kingdom?
Well, there are different ways. There are different strands of two kingdom thought, and Luther was also not utterly consistent. That is, on some questions he said things that I would like better than on other questions. But the general notion of there being two kingdoms, really two ways of ruling, it didn't mean areas and it didn't mean two different kings, but there are two different ways in which God rules, regimes or regimenten, they say in German, that God has two ways of working, is really the same kind of thing I was saying. That for the sake of the salvation of souls and the face-to-face loving living of Christians with one another, then God rules through the gospel. And we can really live that way. But in order to run the pagan society, and most Christians are pagans, Luther thinks, he was very pessimistic about how many true believers there were. In order to run the wider society, God has to do that with the law and with another moral standard, another legal standard. So the two kingdoms just correlate with the distinction I was talking about. So it's an obligation to use non-gospel standards to run the world if you're a prince, or if you're called on by a prince to work for him. I'm sorry that was a little longer, so we didn't have as much time as we should have had for a conversation. Thank you.